This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We are continuing with our series on conversations with remarkable minds. Our topic today, an in-depth look at European and American economies and the threat of free market capitalism and the economic future ahead. Joining us from Greece over Skype is Yannis Varoufakis. He is an international economist, an academic, a former politician, a philosopher, who served as the Minister of Finance for Greece as a member of the Radical Left Party from January 2015 until he resigned in July of this year. Earlier this year, he founded the Democracy in Europe movement, a pan-European movement devoted to reform of the European Union institutions to become more democratic. His stance against the toxic loan and austerity demands being imposed upon Greece by the European banking institutions, frequently referred to as the Troika, earned him international respect as well as condemnation. Bloomberg News called him a brilliant economist, Business Insider, the most interesting man in the world. He is a professor. He received degrees in mathematics from the universities of Essex and Birmingham in the United Kingdom, later a PhD in economics from Essex. And throughout his life, he has been a champion of radical social and economic causes, including involvement in the African National Congress, in the Palestinian cause, and the Solidarity Movement in Chile. He has taught at the Universities of Sydney in Australia, in Athens, the University of Texas at Austin, and other schools. And he's the author of about 10 books, appearing in English. His latest, published by Nation Books, is And the Weak Suffer What They Must, Europe Crisis and America's Economic Future. Nice to have you with us today.
It's very good to be with you.
For listeners who are unfamiliar with the intricacies of the European Union's economics and institutional structures and intrigues, which are very different than those in the United States, I feel we should keep our conversation at the level that the person who's not familiar will at least understand this information. However, one story that Americans are unaware of and is influencing a lot of people within the European Union is how the European Union was created and what role did the American financial aristocrats have in mind when they gave their power, their influence to the creation of this unified umbrella with a single currency, the euro. The U.S. doesn't do anything unless it supports its own sense of superiority and hegemony and self-interest. So how does this entire European experiment benefit the United States?
Let's go back briefly to the New Deal. The New Deal was a remarkable attempt to civilize capitalism by FDR and his team against the background of a remarkable crisis of capitalism, which yielded, amongst other things, the carnage of the Second World War. Sometime during the war, when it became clear to Washington that the Allies would win and the United States economy would emerge from that carnage as the only economy standing, in a sense, the only economy with a surplus, the only economy with whose factories had not been bombed to smithereens, with its infrastructure stronger than ever, its institutions having been built up during the war in a remarkable way, that the United States had to play a hegemonic role in order to save capitalism from itself, and, of course, to keep off the encroachments of the Soviet Union. The New Dealers in power in 1944 convened the famous Bretton Woods Conference at Mount Washington Hotel, where they designed a very interesting system. It was a capitalist system, of course, but nevertheless a planned capitalist system. It is quite intriguing, especially in this day and age, is it not, that Franklin Roosevelt made it a condition for attendance at the Bretton Woods Conference that there should be no banker involved. Bankers had to be kept away way, the financial genie had to be put firmly in its bottle so as not to create another 1929. To cut a long story short, the new dealers in Washington, D.C. were very scared that once the factories in the United States stopped producing tanks and bullets and mortars and the shipyards stopped producing aircraft carriers, that 1929 would return. And they feared that it would happen 20 years later, in 1949. So they designed a monetary system which kept bankers honest to the extent that this is possible, that maintained stability, that planned the international flow of capital from one country to another, that fixed exchange rates, and where the United States played the role of stabilizing global capitalism. This was a remarkable design. It was a remarkable idea. And this was the setting within which the European Union was embedded. The idea of bringing Europeans together, creating a cartel of heavy industry in Central Europe to stop the possibility of a war and to make sure that Europe operates in a controlled fashion as an important appendage to the U.S.-designed global capital system. That is how the European Union came into being, and indeed it prospered together with the rest of capitalism during the golden age of the Bretton Woods system in the 1950s and 60s. But this system that the New Dealers had created in 1944, had designed and then implemented in the next, rolled it out in the next 10 years or so, that system collapsed in 1971 when President Richard Nixon announced the end of a fundamental linchpin of the system. And the reason why that happened was because it was no longer sustainable, because this system was built on the supposition that the United States would be the surplus power in capitalism. And once by 1967, 68, 69, the United States had slipped from a surplus, a trade surplus, to a trade deficit position, that system was no longer sustainable. And Washington insiders, who tend to be quite pragmatic people, and they have to be, or at least used to be, blew up their own invention. And we had the brave new world from the 1970s onwards.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. As the finance minister of Greece, you were elected or appointed to fend off the aggressive conditions thrust upon the Greek people by the Troika in Germany and France and the United States. And these conditions include toxic, unsustainable loans that Greece could never pay off and drastic austerity conditions that would have turned Greece into a basket case and the Greek people's lives into living hells with increased poverty and inequality. In short, the intention, I believe, was to liquefy the Greek state and economy. Now, you've also stated that Greece was the European Union's experiment in austerity. I'd like for you to explain that, and was it intended that Greece serve as a model that the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, and the Central Bank could use on other European nations to just keep recycling debt and surplus in order to keep the European economic plan rolling? And if so, what possible gain could be made by increasing inequality in your own nations? Or was it simply that Brussels and Frankfurt despise democracy or are in contempt of it? And of course, Greece is a symbol of the birth of democracy in the Western world.
Well, everything contained in your question is true. We are running a danger here that we're going to lose the audience because there's so much packed in your question that it sounds impossible for our listeners to understand, when it is very possible, because it really is very, very simple. The bottom line is extremely simple. Let's place it in an American context so our listeners can understand it. I remember in the fall of 2008 when the CEO of Lehman Brothers went cap in hand to Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary of Mr. Bush. Remember that?
Yes.
Lovely moment? Yeah. Now, imagine what would have happened, the incongruity of it all. If when Mr. Fultz, I think that was his name, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, asked for a bailout from Hank Paulson, Imagine if Hank Paulson turned around and said, I'm giving you no bailout. I'm giving you no help with your debt. And I'm forbidding you from defaulting, from going bankrupt. Can you ever imagine that? That would have been a remarkable thing to say. Here you have a bankrupt investment bank. It's about to close down. Imagine if the Treasury Secretary of the United States of America were to say to the CEO of this bankrupt entity, I'm not going to help you, and I forbid you from going bankrupt. It would be incredible. It would not be fathomable. Well, this is exactly what happened in the case of Greece in 2010. Think of Greece as the closest you can get to Lehman Brothers in Europe. What Greece and Lehman's had in common during that period was that our government here in Greece was almost as bankrupt as Lehman Brothers was. Now, the problem was that all the debt that the Greek government had amassed was owed primarily, not all of it, but most of it, to French and German banks, just like Lehman Brothers. It was Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, BNP Paribas, these very, very sickly bankers who had exposed themselves to gigantic debt, just like Lehman's and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs had on your side of the pond. Now, the problem was political, because if Greece was allowed to default, like Lehman Brothers did, Greece, the Greek state, would have defaulted to these German and French banks. There is a profound difference between the United States of America and Europe, especially the Eurozone. In the United States of America, you have the Federal Reserve. Governments get together with Bernanke, then with Janet Yellen, and now, if there is a serious crisis, you can park a lot of bad assets, a lot of bad debts, onto the books of the Federal Reserve. This is what the Federal Reserve did under Bernanke in 2008, 2009. But in Europe, the German government allowed unification at a monetary level and the creation of the European Central Bank on one condition, that the Central Bank of Europe, our Fed, should not be allowed to take on its books the bad debts of the riffraff of Europe, of the Greeks, the Italians, the Spaniards, and so on and so forth. That was a condition that the German authorities imposed for allowing the rest of Europe, the periphery, the riffraff, effectively to use their own currency, the Deutschmark, which has been renamed the euro since the year 2000. So we didn't have a central bank to effectively take on its books all the bad debts of the banks of Germany and of France. If you had the same structure in the United States, if the Fed was not allowed to help Wall Street, then there would be no Wall Street, and the United States would be just as much of a basket case as the Eurozone is today. So because they could not bail out again and again and again Deutsche Bank and Societe Generale, they tried a different trick. They said, okay, we will not allow Greece to default, the Greek government to declare bankruptcy. What we're going to do is we're going to pretend that out of solidarity, out of the pretend solidarity with the Greek people, we're going to give them the largest loan in human history in order to pass it on to those banks to make sure that they do not default. But we will give that money to the Greeks on the pretext that this was an act of solidarity. German politicians had to go to their own parliaments, to their own congresses, in American terms, and say, okay, well, these Greeks are insufferable, they're awful, we have to help them out of solidarity, but we're going to give them some tough love. We're going to impose some austerity upon them, a great deal of austerity upon them, to teach them a lesson. So on the one hand, we will save them from their bankruptcy. On the other hand, we're going to be tough on them. Now, of course, there was no solidarity whatsoever. All the money that they gave to the Greek state, if not all, 91% of it, went to their own banks. It was a hidden bailout. But politically, to pass this bailout of their own banks through the Northern European parliaments, they had to be very tough on Greece through austerity. Well, that led to a Great Depression in Greece. Steinbeck would have written The Grapes of Wrath today with very, very few changes in his text. and in order to portray the situation in Greece. And the formidable error in this is that, of course, once you do that, once you lie to the German parliament, to the French parliament, to the Italian parliament, about what you're giving the Greek government for, and the lie also implies that the Germans and the Italians and the Slovaks would get their money back from Greece, when it is impossible to get their money back from Greece because Greece is bankrupt. And no one has, in the history of capitalism, escaped bankruptcy through more borrowing, especially when the strings that come attached with the borrowing shrink their income. A 10-year-old can understand that. So the politicians like the German chancellor were caught up in a trap of their own making. They lied to their parliament back in 2010, and then they had to keep lying to their parliament. They had to keep giving money to the Greek state so that the Greek state could pretend to be repaying them. So they were taking money from one pocket and putting it in the other pocket, pretending that it was Greece that was repaying them. And every time they did that, they produced more austerity, and the incomes of the Greeks shrunk even further, so the black hole got deeper and deeper and deeper. Now, the result of this is that because Greece was the template, which was then utilized in Spain, in Portugal, in Italy, in Ireland, and so on and so forth, this created a great deflation, very similar to the 1930s, very similar, not identical, because thankfully history does not copy itself entirely, but it does mimic itself. And the problem with deflation, as we know from the 1930s, is that it breeds political monsters. Everywhere you turn in Europe today, you see political monsters.
Yiannis, I also have, after all my travels, seeing how many Americans were suffering, and no one in the media was covering it, no one in the government was discussing it, and there was no activist out there trying to help it. I then took a look at the government and personal debt, and I ask, if we are challenging Greece and condemning Greece, you would hear the commentaries on media that Greece, the wealthy were not paying their income taxes, that the Defense Department bought submarines they didn't need for billions of dollars from Germany, and that there was a great deal of graft and corruption, and therefore they put themselves in this pickle. And I believe at one time, the debt to gross domestic product was around 135% and getting worse. But I did some simple math. Now, my figures are from official sources. Our total debt in the United States, from all sources, is about $170 trillion. Our gross domestic product is around $18 trillion. But if you actually look at the gross domestic product, about $5 trillion of that is from people spending money creating debt, because they have no other way except through their credit cards of buying food or paying bills. And so how in the world do you make a debt that a person has incurred into an asset to make it look as if somehow we're thriving and prosperous and growing? We had 92 million people who had worked who were not working. That puts our unemployment rate at approximately 24 to 27%. But they were saying we had 5% unemployment, and now it's 4.8%. And if I took the total debt to gross domestic product in the United States, we're at about 1,200%, or meaning we have a worse ratio of debt to gross income of any country in the world, and yet everybody's flooding the dollar. Everyone keeps saying, you know, we're the model to follow. And I'm thinking, someone's not seeing the truth here, and yet we will put the Greek people into dire poverty, gross suffering, never focus on it. You've never seen a single story in the United States media about what it means to be a person in Greece today who would have had a quality of life, who now is in dire poverty. So could you address these issues that what we have in the United States in the way of suffering, we do not look at, we do not change. Our debt is never considered important because we're the reserve currency. We're supposed to be the stable person. And we have a Federal Reserve. We'll take trillions of dollars in your junk, if you're a bank, bad investments, and we'll wash it through. We'll magically give you clean money at zero interest, 0.25%, and we will no longer show any bad debt. So everyone's stock goes up, the Wall Street goes up, magical numbers in this equity market, bonds go up. And yet in Greece, we don't want to show the truth. As if I understand what you're saying, 91 cents out of every dollar in these new loans went right to the very people who had the debt to begin with. So they were giving themselves back 91 cents on the dollar, which increased Greece's debt and really didn't impact them. And yet we didn't look at what it means to enforce an austerity program. Could you take us through all of this and even show us what it's like to be a Greek citizen at different levels today and what Greece is like today compared to before in the quality of life, the environment, the way that Greeks would have enjoyed life versus what they're faced with today? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Actually, thank you for reinforcing a feeling of satisfaction I get from the title of my last book. You mentioned it in the introduction kindly. And the weak suffer what they must, whether they live in the United States or whether they live in Greece or indeed in Germany for that matter. But before we become too fatalistic, let me also tell our listeners that at the end of that title, I added a question mark. And this question mark is the source of hope. It implies that, no, they don't suffer what they must. They're suffering what we are being told that they must. But politics is the realm where we can actually resist that which is presented to us as a fate. It is not a fate. Allow me to make a comparison and between Greece and the United States in three parts, and in so doing to address all the good points that you raised. The first one, just again, trying to place the Greek situation in the United States context. Imagine, and let's take one of the deficit, the poorer American states of the Union. Take Louisiana or Missouri. And imagine that in 2008, after the subprime crisis erupted, that the banks of, let's say, Missouri were to be rendered bankrupt because of the subprime collapse. And at the same time, the state of Missouri, suppose it had to pay unemployment benefits and food stamps out of state revenues, while borrowing on the international markets without the help of the Fed, without the help of the federal government, in order to float or refloat the banks domiciled in Missouri. You only have to state this in order to realize that immediately both the state of Missouri, the state government of Missouri, and the banks of Missouri, and the labor market of Missouri, and the developers of Missouri, and the private sector of Missouri would go well and truly insolvent. And imagine that the next step was that, you know, the Federal Reserve, or the International Monetary Fund, California, New York State were to descend upon Missouri and say, okay, we will lend you monies in order to fill those black holes, but on condition that you push sales taxes up from, I don't know what they are in Missouri, maybe there aren't many sales taxes, I'm not familiar with the economy of Missouri, but let's imagine that they said that we are going to introduce a sales tax of 25%, corporate tax of 50%, income tax of 50 or 60%. And that is our condition for lending you the money to repay the debts of the private sector and the public sector, which cannot be repaid. I submit to you, and I think that is quite evident, is it not, that were this to happen in Missouri, Missouri would be a failed state. People would migrate from Missouri, Missouri would become, Detroit would look like a success story compared to Missouri. And this is exactly how Europe worked. Now, that's the first point. The second point is that, yes, you're right, the United States is an amazingly divided society. Now, that division became a lot more pronounced and increasing, turning, evolving into a chasm after the mid-1970s. Remember what we were saying before, the first two decades after the war, the 50s and the 60s, were the golden era of capitalism because the United States surpluses were stabilizing the world. Now, what happened after 1971? What happened was this. The United States achieved something as a global hegemonic power that has never been done before in the annals of history. It increased the geopolitical prowess and power and projected more hegemony around the world at a time when it was increasing its deficits. That has never happened before. When the Roman Empire got into the deficit, its power started waning. The United States managed the opposite. How did it succeed in doing this? On the one hand, the United States was increasingly importing more stuff from Germany, from Japan, later from China, than it was exporting. And it was paying for those deficits by also importing the profits of the capitalists from Germany, from Japan, and increasingly from China. So there was this recycling loop which closed the circle. But in order to be able to do this, the United States officialdom, with Paul Volcker playing a very important role in the late 1970s and early 1980s, you will recall those terrible hikes in interest rates and so on, the United States elites managed to attract other people's capital to the United States in order to close this loop and to pay for the burgeoning deficits of the United States by effecting, implementing ruthless wage repression upon American blue-collar workers. As we all know, the median wage in the United States today is lower in real terms than it was in 1975, lower. And by so doing, American inflation, especially wage inflation, was lower than it was in Europe and Japan, and therefore Japanese and European capital, and later on Chinese capital, had an incentive to flow into Wall Street. This is a model by which America, the elites in America, enhance their power globally by squashing the living daylights out of the American working class. And in return, what they gave the American working class was the promise of financialization. The promise that they would be given a loan, they would buy a house, the house would gain in value, and therefore they would have assets. And of course, that dream collapsed in flames in 2008 with the implosion of Wall Street. By that time, blue-collar workers in the United States, minorities in the United States, the underprivileged in the United States, were dealt a double blow. Firstly, wage repression for so many decades, and secondly, the dream of financialization went up in a puff of smoke. And those discarded people that I'm sure you've depicted magnificently in your documentary are the ones that were left behind by the establishment. Obama promised them to look after them. He did not. And this accumulated pain and depravity translated into the anger, which always, in the end, fuels the fascists like Trump. Now, the case of Greece, of course, is worse, because, as I said, it's what would have happened to Missouri if you didn't have a federal system, if you did not have an FDIC, if you did not have a Fed, if you did not have Social Security that is federally funded, if you did not have the food stamp system. So imagine if in Missouri you did not have any of these things during this crisis, the level of misery and waste that of human beings that would have typified the great state of Missouri. This is Greece for you. Missouri, without all the New Deal institutions like Social Security, FDIC, and so on. And just to make it, bring it home, as we speak, I'm speaking to you folks from Athens, the capital of Greece. As we speak, one in two families has no one working in it. No one. They live off one small pension by some grandparent, grandma, grandfather, a pension that has been shrunk during the austerity years by at least 50-55%. We have a country of 10 million people organized, let's say, around 4.5 million households, of which 3.5 million are in arrears to the tax office, not because they are strategic defaulters, but because they can't pay the tax that has been imposed upon. We have tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of families which simply cannot afford to pay their electricity bill, so you can walk around at night in suburbs of Athens, Thessaloniki, Patara, the major cities, and you will see a lot of apartments in darkness, not because there are no people living there, but because they can't afford to reconnect their electricity supply. We are in a state of Great Depression, and this kind of reality is the one that propelled people like me to the Ministry of Finance back in 2015, when we had a heroic 5-6 month period of trying to liberate Greece from debtor's prison, because this is where we are now, in debtor's prison as a nation, not the whole nation, because as always, during the terrible times, there is a small elite that managed to do very well. Thank you very much.
You've said that Greece, at least from what I understand from your last interview, had no positive future from the outcome of these burdening loans and austerity conditions as it stands with a question mark. So was it ever contemplated that possibly to allow Greece to withdraw from the euro and then perhaps align with other BRIC countries or other developmental banks without the outrageous structural adjustments and austerity provisions that the European central banks were demanding? And also, since the value of a currency would be lowered, you would have a great deal of inexpensive products to people buying them, which would give you some advantage. And there are countries I know that would welcome a chance to work with Greece as opposed to continuing down this road. And the second part of that is, why is it that we simply cannot forgive these debts? Why can't we just simply say we have to, they call it taking a haircut, we have to at some point realize these are unpayable, and there's a point to where how in the world does a person, unless they suffer from cognitive dissonance, how do they say we want to get you healthy so we're going to get more people who have no money to buy anything and we're going to close down businesses? I'm guessing, I don't know how many businesses are in Greece, but I would imagine over 100,000 small businesses. Well, if they can't afford the electricity and they can't afford the supplies, and they can't afford to be in business, a small person is going to go out of business. So it's a catch-22. As long as they continue to say, we want to privatize your ports and your airport and your highways and other resources for our benefit, and then you still have to pay this debt that can never be paid. And oh yeah, one out of every two families is now has no income except after a 50% haircut on a pension, which was not a high pension to begin with. I think it was around $1,200 to $1,400. So you're living on $700 or less a month. And if you've got a family of two having to do that, the older parent who might have the pension and the younger ones who don't, you're living at a poverty, dire poverty conditions, and that's also going to mean you're going to have malnutrition. You're going to have a lot of people suffering from diseases they wouldn't otherwise suffer from. So it doesn't make any sense unless someone has the courage to say, look, this is all stupid and it's a game. Let's just clean it off. Let's clean it off and give Greece a chance, the Greek people a chance to rebuild their economy, rebuild their lives without the burden of us on their back. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, that is what a rational political system would surmise. But unfortunately, we live in a world where our political system is rational. My position when I was there, when I entered government, was really very simple. I didn't have any great interest in getting Greece out of the euro. But at the same time, I didn't fear getting out of the euro. Currencies, in the end, are instruments. I have no fetish for one currency over the other, a national currency versus a transnational currency. What I cared about was what actually works. What could have lifted our people out of poverty? What would have stopped this never-ending negative reinforcement mechanism between authoritarian austerity and debt deflation, on the other hand? So when I accepted the finance ministry, I was appointed finance minister in parliament. In my parliamentary programmatic speech, when I outlined my bargaining position and stands vis-à-vis our creditors, the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, I made a very simple point. I'm going to shower them with moderate, sensible, rational, mutually advantageous proposals. Proposals that in the end would not only be good for us, but it would be good for them too, to the extent of their creditors. And if they keep hitting the stick, the sick cow that is Greece, which has to produce the milk from which they will be repaid, if they keep doing it, the cow is going to die, and they are not going to get their money back either. And at the same time, as outlining moderate, sensible, middle-of-the-road proposals that actually work, I would at once state it in no uncertain terms that I am not going to budge. And I'm not going to accept another toxic loan, another predatory loan from them on conditions that reinforce the debt deflationary cycle. And if they want to threaten Greece, us, me, with expulsion from the common currency, from the euro, what I was not saying to my interlocutors in Brussels, in Frankfurt, in Berlin, I would look at them in the eye after having outlined very moderate proposals, and I would say, well, if you don't want to discuss the substance of the crisis, if you don't want to have a sensible discussion about how to end the Greek crisis, I'm not going to sign up, and you do your worst. And do I look scared? I'm not. What I am really scared of is the perpetuation of this Great Depression, of this. And so, yes, it would be a major cost if we're thrown out of the euro. It would be short term, and then within a year or two or three, we would recover. And you know what? They would never, if we stood steady on this and steadfast, they would never have thrown us out. They would have given us a reasonable deal. Why? Because it would have cost them, in American terms, I had calculated around $1.2 trillion to get us out. And they would never have done that. And their game was simply a war of attrition, hoping that they would scare us off, and primarily that they would divide us. They would divide me from my Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, which is something they succeeded. They terrorized him into accepting, and then I resigned on the night of that magnificent no referendum. So that's the first point I want to make. The second point is just to explain why they behave that way. See, to put it differently, you know what my tragedy was as a negotiator, as a chief negotiator and finance minister? I was negotiating with creditors that didn't want their money back. You know, this is a very difficult negotiation to have. Imagine negotiating with your banker terms for restructuring your loan to the bank and don't realize that the bank doesn't care about getting some money back. The only thing they care about is crushing you. Now, the bank would never be that stupid. But the European Union did want to crash us. They didn't care about getting their money back. And why did it make sense to them to crash us? The reason was very simple. It's a postmodern version of gunboat diplomacy. They wanted to crash our government that dared say no to them, so as to send a message to the people of Spain, to the people of Portugal, to the people of Ireland, to the people of Italy, and ultimately to the people of France, that if they dare elect a government that does not bow its head to the irrational policies, which are the result of the urge and the tendency to save the bankers above anything else, and to continue lying to the people serially, just like, you know, Macbeth. Once Macbeth commits a crime, then he has to commit a second crime in order to cover up the first crime. That's the kind of relationship that these politicians have with their own parliaments. They lie to them, and they have to keep lying to them by means of more toxic economic policies. So this is what we were facing. We had a great opportunity in 2015 to effect a major debt relief program for Greece, to haircut our debt, to do it in a sensible, modest way, through debt swaps, things that Wall Street does every day, in order to give degrees of freedom to our economy and allow it to breathe again and start growing and start improving not only everyday life, but also the mood of the people. we had such a great opportunity, and unfortunately our government was divided. The result is some of us who would not budge left the government. Now my former comrades and colleagues remain in government. They're not in power. They have to implement one humiliating measure and law after the other. So to answer your most poignant question, why can't we just have a sensible restructuring of the debt? The answer is the kind of toxic authoritarian politics that we have, which is predicated upon spreading fear in the European periphery in order to maintain the power structures at the core, which is interestingly not succeeding at all. I mean, look at the trials and tribulations of the establishment in Central Europe is now facing. You know, the chickens are coming home to roost. This ploy of theirs, their gunboat, postmodern gunboat diplomacy, has backfired on them. Yes, they might. My prime minister and former friend and comrade Alexis Tsipras to capitulate. They forced Spain to capitulate, forced Portugal to capitulate, forced Ireland to capitulate. But now the deflationary evil forces that they have unleashed in trying to do this are attacking them at home. We have the rise of neo-Nazis, neo-fascists, xenophobes and racists in Germany, in France, in Austria, in Hungary, everywhere, because what they did in defiance of logic, the logic of restructuring debt and creating a kind of new deal for Europe, this denial has unleashed deflationary forces. And as we know from the 1930s, deflation breeds political monsters.
Very, very important insight that you just shared with us. I thank you. When you look at Italy today, it has over almost $2 trillion in debt. France, right up there with it, those are two of the largest economies along with Germany. Germany has debt. All these countries have debt. The fact that they abdicate to these hegemonic power sources in Brussels doesn't mean that anything's improved. You have austerity programs in each of those countries. The real estate market crashed and burned in all these countries, including in Ireland. So when you go to Ireland, you look at what the economy was doing in the 1980s, 90s, where it was growing, where they had almost zero unemployment. In fact, people were going from other countries to Ireland. Now they have a massive unemployment level. For those people who got in there and bought the farms and the townhouses and the castles on the cheap, that's not a sign that the economy is growing. That's like the people coming in and exploiting another person's advantage, where you profit at someone else's loss. None of this is going to end well, because one country sooner or later is going to rebel, and you're going to have massive, uncontrollable riots. That is inevitable. We just don't know where, which country, and when. Do you see this also?
Yes, of course I do. But remember, the situation in Italy and in France is particularly disturbing, because these countries do not have a central bank. Now, if you have a central bank like in the United States, you can park a lot of the bad debt, pretend that you have sorted it out, but in the end, all you do is you park it on the books of the Federal Reserve and you forget it for the next 10 centuries or so. That's one way that companies manage to overcome debt crisis, by using central bank. Now, France and Italy do not have a central bank. So they are trying to deal with the debt, especially the banking losses that contributed massively to it, by cutting pensions and cutting investment and cutting the wages of the low paid. And no one has managed to overcome large banking crises to cut that. It is impossible to pay off the massive banking losses through cutting old age pensioners, snow stipends. It has never been done, it has not been done, it will not be done. Let's consider for just one moment on Italy. Because Italy is a magnificent example of the incongruities and the silliness of the European Union. The reason why I'm picking out Italy, not only because it's been in the news recently with the referendum that Matteo Renzi, the Prime Minister, lost, causing him to resign and creating a political crisis, but primarily for economic reasons. Italy, unlike Britain, unlike the United States, unlike Greece, unlike Australia, Italy has a current account surplus. It sells more to the rest of the world, both in terms of goods and services, than it imports from the rest of the world. It is a successful economy in that sense. It pays its way in the international global capitalist arena. Its government, with all the corruption and problems that the Italian government has, you know, nevertheless, the Italian government has a primary budget surplus, if only the your federal government had it. So what this means is, in everyday language, that the Italian state takes more taxes in than it spends on anything, except debt repayment. So I'm leaving debt repayment out. But it has a surplus if you subtract its expenditure from its tax take. A country which has a twin surplus, a surplus in its trade and service accounts with the rest of the world, and the government that has a surplus, should be flying high. It should be doing well. It should not be in perpetual crisis. Now, the reality, however, is that the Italian debt as a proportion of GDP is increasing, even though the country has a twin surplus. And the reason why this is happening, of course, is because it is embedded in a very badly designed monetary system, which was designed in the first place in order to maintain the capacity of a cartel of big business in Europe, spanning Germany, France, Belgium, Netherlands, and Northern Italy. A cartel needs to have price stability, needs to have a common currency, like OPEC, the organization of petroleum exporting countries, has the dollar as a common currency at which it sells oil. That Central European cartel had to have a common currency, created a common currency. Big business did very well for a long while, but this common currency now is strangulating Italy. And if Italy asphyxiates, then France is out, and if France is out, then the euro collapses. Now, some of our listeners may say, well, if it's such a badly designed monetary system, let it collapse. Well, I'm tempted to say that too, but you have to be very, very careful. Remember the last time a common currency system collapsed under deflationary pressures? It was in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And you remember very well what happened as a result. The political center imploded. It was not the left and progressives that benefited from it. It was a nationalist international, a neo-fascist, a fascist international, a Nazi international that rose up and created so much human pain. Now, this is why I find myself in a very, very strange situation. I opposed the creation of the Eurozone back in the 90s when it was created. I certainly opposed the entry, the accession of Greece into this common currency area. But now I'm losing a lot of friends on the left because I'm saying that the solution is not to get out. The solution is to try to fix it, which of course means that we should not fear getting out. It's what I was saying. It's this dialectical point that I'm trying to make for years now, and which I tried to make when I was in the ministry. I demand a fundamental change, a new deal for Europe, a new deal for Greece within the euro, and I'm not going to budge. And if you want to destroy the euro, because you're denying Europeans this new deal, do it. But the moral weight of doing it falls upon your shoulders, not mine.
Interesting perspective. I'm not sure that the average person fully appreciates what you're saying, and they either are unaware and want to stay in, or they want to get out. But the people in power are the ones who ultimately, this triarchy, they're the ones who ultimately call the shots. And if they have not been willing to be compassionate and supportive and understanding, then I don't see them yielding. Much like for years, for decades, African and South American countries principally would borrow money from the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, and along came structural adjustments, and suddenly they could pay off the loan, but because of interest and because of structural adjustments, they, and having to give their nation's resources over to these private corporations, they never got out of debt. And now those countries became economic basket cases and rife for corruption. And in fact, one of the people driving me, a cab driver, drove me to the studio today, and it happens he was from Nigeria, and he said, we are the fifth largest person within OPEC. We have an abundance of oil. We're the largest populated country in Africa, of the 54 countries in Africa. He said, and yet not a single person that he knows of ever gets elected because they want to serve the public. They want to serve themselves. It's a ticket to steal. And whether it's stealing money or it's gaining power, we have to look if this is not also the case with many of the people controlling the European Union. Your final thought, please.
Donald Trump symbolizes, amongst all the awfulness that surrounds his rise, something that we progressives must take to heart, that it is possible to confront the establishment and win. What Trump has done, of course, is to confront the establishment with misanthropic oversimplifications. Our task is to fight the establishment with a nuanced narrative that manages to harness the anger and the hope in a progressive direction.
Well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate you being on today, Yanis, to share your insights on the European and American economies and the threats of free market capitalism and the economic future ahead. And again, his book, which is recommended reading because it goes into this in some depth, and I want people to know more about that. By the way, who's your publisher on the book? Yanis, who's your publisher?
Oh, my publisher is Nation Books, the good people of Nation Books.
Oh, good.
Who have done a magnificent job of producing this book.
Good. And the title is, And the Weak Suffer What They Must.
With a question mark at the end, which is the subversive part and source of hope.
And I agree. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your input.
Hey, what's up, man? Brother, what's up? Oh, this is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, stop right on.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, father, don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today.
Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me,
sister,
with brutality,
sister.
Talk to me,
sister,
so you can see,
sister.
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh,
right, right on.
Oh, but who would they judge us simply 'cause I'm